Today is Tuesday, June 9th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. George Floyd will be laid to rest as millions continue to mourn his death and call for reform.
Floyd's funeral will be followed by burial at the Houston Memorial Garden Cemetery, where Floyd will be laid to rest next to his mother, Larsenia Floyd.
Plus, new research on COVID-19.
And we can see that those antibodies are bound right on the surface, exactly at the point that the viral protein needs to get into cells.
And North Korea says it will cut ties with the South. Again, those stories and more next. Family and friends honored George Floyd with a private funeral Tuesday in the U.S. city of Houston, Texas, 2 weeks after his death in police custody inspired renewed protests against police brutality in numerous cities across the country. The AP's Mike Gracia starts us off.
2 weeks and a day after his death in Minneapolis that triggered protests across the nation, final services for George Floyd are today in Houston. Floyd's funeral will be followed by burial at the Houston Memorial Garden Cemetery, where Floyd will be laid to rest next to his mother, Larsenia Floyd. Former Vice President Joe Biden, who met with Floyd's family Monday, will offer a video message for the funeral service. An estimated 6,000 people attended a public service Monday. Monday night, the Jack Yates National Alumni Association held a candlelight vigil for Floyd, who was in the class of 1993. I'm Mike Gracia.
Monday, Derek Chauvin, the white officer who was filmed pressing his knee against Floyd's neck for more than 8 minutes before Floyd's death, made his first court appearance since the charges against him were upgraded to second-degree murder. Chauvin said little during the brief hearing at a Minneapolis court as he appeared on closed-circuit television from a maximum-security prison. His next court appearance is set for June 29th. Some American protesters are calling for defunding police departments to stop police brutality and racism. Already, the Minneapolis City Council has voted to disband its police department and replace it with a community-led effort. Democratic lawmakers in Congress unveiled proposed legislation on Monday designed to overhaul police procedures. Georgetown University law professor Christy Lopez says the proposal from Democrats will make many nervous.
First of all, it makes people think that whomever is saying that believes that we should have no police starting tomorrow. And that scares people because they don't know what that looks like. And they think about, what if my house gets broken into, or what if, you know, I'm mugged? I need to be able to call somebody. And so they don't understand that it's a call to begin remaking public safety in a very deliberate way.
White House spokeswoman Kayleigh McEnany told reporters on Monday that U.S. President Donald Trump is appalled by calls from some protesters and activists for police departments to be defunded. She said that the president is taking a look at various proposals in response to Floyd's death, but offered no specifics. It has not been since the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 60s that the United States has witnessed such an outcry for racial equality. Many of those protesting say that the death of George Floyd was the breaking point in a long list of African-American deaths at the hands of police, as well as 400 years of racial inequality. International Edition's Lori London spoke with Karen Gray Houston, journalist and author of the book Daughter of the Boycott. They began their conversation by discussing how the civil rights movement of years past compared to what's taking place today.
My book starts with a case of white police brutality. There was a man named Hilliard Brooks, who was a friend of my father's, and like my dad, was also a World War II veteran. And he tried to get a ride on a bus in downtown Montgomery back in 1950. A police officer was called because he had been acting drunk and disorderly. However, when the police officer arrived, he took out a gun and he shot and killed that person. This is how it differs from how people are responding now. My father and an AMVETS commander at the school where they were teaching veterans, a black Catholic school, decided to write a letter to city officials, to the mayor and to the police chief, and say, we want that police officer prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. Well, that didn't happen. A white police review board found that it was a justifiable shooting. And so my dad and this other gentleman, they organized a massive march of veterans downtown in Montgomery, a march with a purpose. They carried signs that said, ballots will beat bullets, and they marched to the courthouse where people could register to vote. vote. So it was really a very peaceful way of handling a very bad situation. This was 5 years before Martin Luther King actually even got involved and started talking about nonviolent civil disobedience. And back to that case, the marchers had an encounter with police, but it was a very peaceful one. A sheriff's deputy came over and said, hey, you guys have to put those signs down. And they basically agreed to put the signs down, but they didn't stop marching. Mm-hmm. And so there was none of the violence. There wasn't any looting. There wasn't any burning. Nobody mm-hmm. vandalized anything. What happened with that case of white police brutality was in keeping with the same kind of philosophy that Dr. King was preaching during the boycott, which happened 5 years later, nonviolent civil disobedience.
This is so deeply embedded into your life as a journalist. Were you shocked to see all of the fires and looting and violence and destruction this time around?
We have never seen anything like this before, but we've seen a cycle of excessive force by white officers against unarmed black men that for whatever reason continues to happen. As I was working on the book, doing my research in 2015, there was a whole rash of police brutality cases. I can't even name them all. And so there were protests then, and there were college students who were protesting. We didn't see the same level of, it wasn't quite the powder keg that things that erupted in this situation. But, you know, it happens and it keeps happening. And as I was working on the book, I met some people in Montgomery, Alabama I didn't know. I went to the neighborhood I used to live in as a little girl, and there were signs on people's lawns that said, "Justice for Greg Gunn." Greg Gunn was a black man who was walking down the street one night in 2016, and a white police officer stopped him. There was an exchange, an encounter of some kind, and the officer ended up tasing him, chasing him, beating him, and shooting him to death. That didn't get adjudicated until finally 2019. There were about 8 different judges. Some of them were found not fit to handle the case. Some recused themselves. Eventually, the white police officers' lawyers asked for the trial to be moved. They had a change of venue, and I thought the white officers' legal defense team thought that would be better for him. The case got tried in a rural town in Alabama, and a jury of mostly white people found the white police officer guilty, but not of first-degree murder. It was of a lesser charge of manslaughter, but it was kind of a surprising verdict for a place in the Deep South, and very unexpected. And as I ended the book, it gave me kind of a glimmer of hope. And now this.
What would you say to the young people out there who say they're happy that the charges have been amended, and but that this isn't finished and they will stay out there? What would you say to them to encourage them to stay strong and keep fighting for the justice they believe in?
I think they should stay out there, and they should continue to march, and they should ignore the president calling for the military to come in and confront them. If they can keep their demonstration peaceful to get their points across, they are understanding that the looting and the setting things on fire isn't the answer, though. I had a conversation with a young man who went down to Lafayette Park across from the White House, and he says he's been involved in peaceful demonstrating, but that he has talked to some of the people who were doing the looting. What they were saying was that they felt that looting these big stores, it's like their way of getting back reparations that they feel that they are due. I don't understand that, but I think they should continue. I think, you know, you need more and better dialogue between the races, and what I'm seeing that's different now from what I saw in earlier demonstrations back in the 60s and the 70s is that the protesters seem to be largely a more diverse group, more black and white people together. But what's more important than anything else now is getting people out to vote. Younger people and some of the millennials have had a history of not thinking that voting is so important. But if you want to make fundamental change, you've got to change the leadership at the top, and you've just got to get to the polls and make sure you vote so you can make a difference.
Karen Gray Houston is the author of the book Daughter of the Boycott. She was speaking to International Edition's Lori London. The U.S. protests have also led to demonstrations in other countries, with the people showing both solidarity with those marching in the United States and calling attention to cases in their own countries. For example, France is one of the nations that has seen protests, and the country's interior minister announced that police will no longer be allowed to use chokeholds during arrests. Inspired by the global protests, some 30,000 people in Belgium have signed two petitions to remove statues of the country's colonial-era King Leopold II, whose troops decimated the Democratic Republic of the Congo in the late 1800s. And today, at least one of those statues came down in the city of Antwerp. We do have extended coverage of the protests on our website, that address, voanews.com. Still to come in today's program...
Weekend protests in Beirut over government corruption and mismanagement quickly sparked into rioting and sectarian violence, leaving dozens injured, including 25 soldiers. In other parts of Lebanon, shooting and clashes erupted between Shiite Hezbollah supporters and other demonstrators. Analysts say there are now renewed calls for the powerful Hezbollah militia, also represented in the government and parliament, to disarm.
This is VOA News.
In a minute.
Of Saturn's 82 moons, Titan, its largest, has been of specific interest to scientists. Titan is the only moon in the solar system to have its own thick atmosphere. And according to NASA, the giant moon is the only other object in our grouping of planets to have a liquid cycle, from rain to flowing liquid on its surface to evaporating back into the sky to begin another cycle. Titan, like Earth's moon and others, is also widening its orbit and pulling away from its planet due to the give-and-take gravitational energy between planet and moon. Scientists calculated that our moon is drifting away at 3.8 centimeters per year. Digging through data gathered by NASA's 13-year Cassini mission, scientists were surprised to learn that Titan is pulling away from Saturn at 11 centimeters per year, which is faster than thought. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
According to a study by the Imperial College of London, lockdowns and closing non-essential businesses and schools may have saved about 3 million lives in 11 countries across Europe during the pandemic. A separate study in the United States concluded that lockdowns in China, France, Iran, Italy, South Korea, and the U.S. prevented another 530 million COVID-19 cases. But the World Health Organization warned on Monday that while the situation was improving in Europe, it is getting worse in other parts of the world. The WHO said 75% of the new cases are in 10 countries, mostly in Latin America and South Asia. All over the world, scientists are looking for a vaccine that protects against COVID-19, and others are searching for a treatment to knock out the virus until a vaccine is available. VOA's Carol Pearson reports that researchers in Sweden are optimistic about their work on a treatment that could slow the progression of the disease, ease symptoms, and save lives.
Tyson may become the world's most famous alpaca. Researchers from the Karolinska Institute in Stockholm have immunized him with coronavirus proteins and isolated tiny antibodies known as nanobodies in his blood. Antibodies are proteins that are produced by your immune system when it senses the body has been infected with a virus or another foreign body. The proteins then try to kill it off. Nanobodies are far smaller than the antibodies humans produce, and nanobodies bind to the same part of the virus that human antibodies do. Gerald McKinnery is one of the scientists working on this project.
So these are the antibodies that we took from the alpaca's blood cells, and we can see that those antibodies are bound right on the surface, exactly at the point that the viral protein needs to get into cells. And so this gives us a structural understanding of how these antibodies work to stop the infection.
McKinnery says the results will be published in a few months. The work could lead to a drug that would help reduce the amount of virus in a patient's blood while the immune system develops its own response to the infection.
All the evidence would suggest that it will work very well in humans, but it's a very complex system, so we look forward to getting to do those experiments.
A vaccine could take years to develop, which is why the scientists at the Karolinska Institute focused on developing a treatment. It could help stop the pandemic while a vaccine is being developed that offers long-term immunity. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
An Iranian citizen who provided information to U.S. and Israeli intelligence services on the whereabouts of Iran's slain top commander Qasem Soleimani will be executed soon, according to Iran's judiciary. On January 3rd, a U.S. drone strike in Iraq killed Soleimani, the head of Iran's elite Quds Force. Washington blamed Soleimani for masterminding attacks by Iran-aligned militia on U.S. forces in the region. Hong Kong Chief Executive Carrie Lam warned on Tuesday the city would not afford further chaos as activists marked a year of sustained pro-democracy rallies with lunchtime protests in several shopping malls. Almost 9,000 people aged between 11 and 84 have been arrested in relation to protests over the past year, according to police. More than 600 were charged with rioting. Prominent pro-democracy activist Joshua Wong said the world had borne witness to the deteriorating situation in Hong Kong, with Beijing tightening its grip over the city's liberties. Thousands of Israelis gathered in Tel Aviv's Rabin Square Saturday, chanting Palestinian Lives Matter to protest Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's pledge to begin annexing parts of the West Bank next month. Israeli Knesset member Nitzan Horowitz, the head of the leftist Meretz party, told the crowd that annexation would be a war crime. VOA's senior analyst Mohammed El Shenawi spoke with Ori Ner, spokesman for Americans for Peace Now, about the unusual pro-Palestinian rally and the timing of annexation before the U.S. presidential elections.
Well, what I think Nitzan was trying to say, and I agree with him on that, is that annexation will be a violation of international law. It violates international law both in the sense that you are not supposed to annex territory that was taken by force, and this is territory that has been under Israeli occupation since it was taken by force at the war of 1967. It's also a violation of Israel's internationally recognized agreement with the Palestinian leadership, with the PLO, the Oslo Agreement, which was signed in 1995, or what they call Oslo II. So in two ways, this violates both international law and Israel's internationally recognized agreement with its Palestinian neighbors. And in that sense, I agree with Nitzan.
Vermont Senator and former Democratic presidential candidate Bernie Sanders addressed the rally in a video message from the United States, and he said the plans to annex any parts of the West Bank must be stopped, the occupation must be ended, and we must work together for a future of equality and dignity for all people in Israel and Palestine. Does Americans for Peace Now agree with Sanders' position?
We definitely agree with the position that there should be an Israel and a Palestine. There should be two states. There should be a Palestinian state should be established. And what annexation does is it actually blocks the way for the establishment of a Palestinian state. The West Bank has been under Israeli occupation, under military law, and the world to some extent acquiesced with the situation because the situation was perceived as temporary, pending an Israeli-Palestinian peace agreement that would bring about the establishment of a Palestinian state, what we call a two-state solution. Once Israel announces that it annexes a third, 30% of the West Bank, it basically says we're not interested anymore in a two-state solution. We are establishing facts on the ground in a unilateral fashion. We're not negotiating the future of the West Bank. That means that a two-state solution is no longer possible. If a two-state is no longer possible, what is it that the Palestinians can pursue? Well, it is equality. Equality within the context of one state, of a state that extends from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean, which basically means the end of Israel as we know it. The end of Israel as a Jewish state and as a democracy. And that's something that we don't support. We know that most Israelis don't support. Indeed, most people around the world don't support. People want to see an independent Israeli Jewish state. That is how I read what Senator Sanders was saying, and we definitely agree with him on that.
A recent public opinion survey showed that 58% of Israelis believe annexation could lead to a third Palestinian uprising. However, Israel's prime minister told settler leaders that it's critical to speed up the annexation before the U.S. elections. Can you explain why?
Yes, I think that what has happened here is that Prime Minister Netanyahu is seeking a legacy. He knows that this is most probably, almost certainly, his last term.
Ori Ner is a spokesman for Americans for Peace Now, and he was speaking to VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawy. Protests in Beirut in recent days over government corruption and mismanagement quickly escalated into rioting and sectarian violence that included clashes between Shiite Hezbollah supporters and other demonstrators. Analysts say there are now renewed calls for the powerful Hezbollah militia, also represented in the government and parliament, to disarm. Dale Gavlak has more.
Analysts say Lebanon may be facing its biggest threat to stability since the end of the country's 15-year-old civil war in 1990. A spiraling economic crisis, the coronavirus outbreak, and national protests have raised fears of a new slide into sectarian violence. While demanding better living conditions and tougher measures to fight corruption, demonstrators are urging Hezbollah to disarm. That demand ignited violent rage from supporters of the powerful Shiite paramilitary group backed by Iran, forcing Lebanese President Michel Aoun to call for national unity. Lebanon maintains a fragile sectarian balance after its many religious sects fought the civil war. Professor Habib Malik of the Lebanese American University tells VOA that the spotlight on Hezbollah's misconduct is raising calls to counter its powerful influence over Lebanon.
Hezbollah is much more disliked, or I would say even hated, on the streets. They realize that Hezbollah is a big obstacle in the rescuing of Lebanon and is a big contributor to where we have reached in Lebanon. Hezbollah's own personal involvement in corruption. The mere fact that they actually protect and cover up for well-known corrupt individuals and groups, that's enough to implicate them in the whole corruption thing.
Lebanon is one of the world's most indebted countries, with debt equivalent to more than 170% of its GDP. Ongoing talks with the International Monetary Fund over an initial $10 billion bailout could be jeopardized by Hezbollah, fearing the reforms required by donors to tackle the financial crisis. Political forces in Lebanon have also renewed pressure on Hezbollah to reform or face possible U.S. sanctions under legislation known as the Caesar Act because of its military support to the Syrian government. Would prove catastrophic for the country, analysts say. Mona Alami, a non-resident senior fellow with the Atlantic Council's Middle East program, says Hezbollah had worked for years on integrating itself into the Lebanese state. Now that the country is falling apart, Hezbollah's assimilation into the state apparatus could pose a direct threat to the group's future, as well as to Lebanon, Alami says. Iran's dwindling financial support to Hezbollah, Alami says, has made it increasingly reliant on the state. Its control over Lebanon's borders with Syria also have allowed it to engage in a number of smuggling activities, including food, petrol, and drugs, and counterfeiting money, sources close to the fighters have told her. Alami says Hezbollah is forced to maintain a belligerent foreign policy aligned with Iran at Lebanon's expense, while locally it is the hostage of discredited allies. Both are running Lebanon into oblivion. Lebanese have held protests since October to demand political change. Dale Gavlak for VOA News, Amman.
North Korea's state news agency said it will sever hotlines with South Korea as the first step towards shutting down all contact with Seoul. Reuters' Libby Hogan has the details.
For several days, North Korea has lashed out at South Korea, threatening to close a liaison office and other projects if the South does not stop defectors from sending leaflets and other material into the North. And the abrupt move will come as soon as noon on Tuesday, when the North will close lines of communication at both an inter-Korean liaison office and hotlines between the two militaries and presidential offices. On Tuesday morning, North Korean officials did not answer a routine daily call to the liaison office, nor calls on military hotlines, Yonhap News Agency reported. The decision to cut communications marks a setback in efforts to try and persuade North Korea to give up its nuclear weapons program in exchange for relief on tough international sanctions. The two Koreas remain technically at war because the 1950 to 1953 Korean War ended with an armistice rather than a peace treaty.
Libby Hogan reports for Reuters News. You've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser on your phone, your tablet, your computer, or any other device to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and good night.